Carl has done a little survey for us, which is quite amusing. Just asking people what they think of the podcast.
Should we start?
Yeah.
Well, what have we all been up to? Come on, everybody. But I can't talk about the Trump baby balloon, because by the time we go, it'll be old news by the time we go on.
Shall I tell you an amusing exam-related story? Although, yeah, one of the things in the survey was, you know, maybe that chuntering around you do at the beginning could be a little shorter. So my youngest son, Rory, 16, has just been doing his GCSEs, and the school rang this week and said, we've had a message from the exam board saying that Rory Mitchinson's English paper had a story on it in it of such graphic brutality that they're worried that he might be being, you know, he's at risk for abuse or really quiet. So the school said, well, no, he's just reads a lot of books,
yeah,
does his own thing, drums.
He's a quiet lad.
And I said, he's a quiet lad. And he was hilarious. He said, well, yeah, it was a story on the theme of something unexpected. So he said, I'd sort of written something in class. It started as a bit of a cheesy romance, and then I sort of thought, you know, move it into full-blown horror. And as it was an exam, he said, you know, I sort of thought I'd really go for it. It's great. Everybody at work said, oh, can we option his first collection of stories?
Yeah.
It's a shoo-in for a Netflix.
Well, two things about it. One is, obviously, it sounds like he's done quite well in his English language paper. But the other is, it's sort of quite good that the exam board is that alert.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
It's,
yeah.
But it is that thing of imagination and reality.
And that they're actually reading them.
Well, I did say to Rory, I said, if they do ask you to go into a room with a pair of dolls. And welcome to Backlisted, the podcast that gives new life to old books. Today, you find us huddled together in the white city of Minas Tirith, gazing nervously across the Pelennor fields towards the ominous shadow billowing towards us from the black land of Mordor, where the shadows lie. I'm John Mitchinson, the publisher of Unbound, the platform where readers crowdfund the books they really want to read.
And I'm Andy Miller, author of The Year of Reading Dangerously. And joining us today is Dan Kieran, author and entrepreneur and co-founder of Unbound, our sponsors. Dan is the author of 12 books, including the timeless classic Crap Towns, co-edited with our friend Sam Jordison, and the soon-to-be-published The Surfboard, How Using My Hands Helped Unlock My Mind. And we welcome back Dr. Una McCormack, a British/Irish writer and academic who has appeared on two previous Backlisteds, talking about, first of all, Georgia Heyer, and then Anita Bruckner. I would have to say, any prospective employees, listen, look at Dr. McCormack's range. Heyer, Bruckner and Tolkien.
All the greats.
Una lectures in creative writing at Anglia Ruskin and is co-director of the Anglia Ruskin University Centre for Science Fiction and Fantasy, but is best known as the New York Times best-selling author of a series of tie-in novels for both Star Trek and Doctor Who. And you were saying to me earlier, Una, that when you've actually taken time out from writing a book at the moment, haven't you? Which you've got a significant proportion left to go. You took time out for us
Lord of the Rings. Unbelievably under the cosh, but I would drop everything to podcast about Lord of the Rings.
Yay! Great. So, John.
Well, yes, we are here to talk about Lord of the Rings, but specifically the third volume in the trilogy, The Return of the King by J.R.R. Tolkien, first published in 1955. And by Alan and Unwin, and easily the least obscure book, I think it would be fair to say, we have ever done on Backlisted. The book of the century.
That, right?
Anyway, before we strap on our shields and face the Nazgul, we're delighted to welcome back our sponsor, Spoke, the sharp, smart online menswear company. Spoke design men's trousers and now seasonally appropriate shorts and polo shirts. With a difference, they fit you and not the other way around. With their online fit finder, enter a few simple details and in under a minute you'll have the perfect fit. You can choose from almost 200 size combinations. Spoke obsess over every detail, fabric, lining, fasteners, Ordering from Spoke is like going to your own tailor without the hassle or expense. You get sharp, personalised design delivered in just 2 working days. And as a backlisted listener, if you go to www.spoke-london.com and place an order, you'll get £20 off your first order. Just use the code BACKLISTED20. Terms and conditions apply. Once more, I'm here in my Spoke trousers and loving them. But Spoke shorts, they have a particularly Tolkien-like colour called cobalt, which I don't know, I feel a pair of cobalt shorts might have to come my way before the end of the holidays. But first, from leg dressing to mind expanding, Andy, what have you been reading this week?
What have I been reading this week? Okay, so listeners, we have had a few weeks off. We haven't actually recorded an episode for a month.
We were.
And I took that opportunity to read 20 books that I didn't have to read for backlisted. I've read loads of things that I've been waiting to read for quite some time, but often they'd sort of had to be put to one side because we were working on episodes about other writers and we had to do all this reading and blah, 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 blah. So I read about 20 books and I just thought I'd mention a few of the books that I read that I really liked in that period. One of them was Sons and Lovers by a little guy called D.H. Lawrence.
David Herbert Lawrence.
Who I had never read any D.H. Lawrence. And John is, of course, he's one of your favourite authors. He's one of Rachel's favourite authors as well, right?
Yeah.
So I read that. I thoroughly enjoyed that.
Yeah.
I read Happy by Nicola Barker, which has won the Goldsmiths Prize and is the most wonderful, baffling, typographically challenging, print-defying novel that I've read for ages. I really recommend that, John. That is a really... Great. That really does things to your head, that, but really, really great novel. I read The Crowell House, which has just been republished by Penguin.
Simenon.
So that's Georges Simenon. It's one of the Roman Dur, and it was Anita Bruckner's favourite.
That's right.
Simenon. Oh. And it is incredible. It is a book about immigration and the way immigrants get treated, whether they try to fit in or don't try to fit in. It's incredibly bleak, but also so contemporary. Julian Barnes had a piece in the LRB last year saying that he had read it after Anita Bruckner died because it was her favourite, and that he was totally taken aback about the extent. If you want to read a book about what's happening in Europe at the moment, written 80 years ago, which feels distressingly contemporary, that's the book to go for. So that's The Crowell House by Georges Simenon. And I also read a book that Faber have just republished by Derek Taylor, the Beatles press officer, called As Time Goes By, his memoir written in the mid-70s about working at Apple and about, which is just, you know, that's got Andy Miller written through it like a stick of rock. So I read all these books, but my favourite book that I read, and actually I'm not going to say too much about it because I think there's a good chance that we will do a full episode of Backlisted on this novel, was Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban, which I've got a Picador copy here, and on the front they've done that thing where rather than put an illustration on it, they've just filled the cover with quotes from the reviews that were published at the time. This book was published in 1979. A masterpiece, The Observer. Extraordinary, it will be a cult book, The Listener. Stunning, The New York Times. A real achievement, The Guardian. This is what literature is meant to be, Anthony Burgess. Can't disagree with any of those. Yeah. An utterly remarkable novel, which... Furthermore, until I opened it up and started reading it, I had no idea it was set exactly in the bit of Kent that I live in.
Indeed. Yeah.
In a dystopian Kent, which is much like actually Kent is now.
Is the chip golem in it?
The chip golem probably... You know what? The chip chippy golem is probably in here somewhere, right? And so I'm not going
to... The babby.
I'm not going to read anything from it because it... Because you'd need to practice before you read anything loud from this book. It's written in a very brilliant, peculiar, broken-up vernacular. I actually read out parts of this to myself out loud while I was reading because it seemed like the best way to understand what was happening.
I read the opening paragraph to my master's creative writing students and try to get them to guess where it's from. And they never get it, but they get to estuary, but they don't get to... Post-apocalyptic Kent.
I was reading it and enjoying it and being challenged by it, and I couldn't quite understand what was going on. And then it gets to a bit which won't be a spoiler, which society has fallen apart several hundred years in the future, or no, thousand years in the future, where a group of people tour the country with an ancient Punch and Judy show, reinforcing social messages via that route, which I thought was one of the most mind-popping things that I have ever read in a book. A book that had already sent me on a journey. I couldn't believe how good it was.
Yeah.
And the reason why I'm mentioning it and saying I hope we do it on the podcast is, of course, that two people around this table have not read it, and the two people who have read it, it is almost their favourite book, right?
It's very close to being. I mean, it's the one, absolutely. It's unforgettable, and if you know, it's the novel. When anybody says doing something new with language, doing something new with the novel,
yeah.
Ridley Walker is always the touchstone for me. It's fresh. I mean, you've just picked it up and read it. It was written in 1979. It could have been written. I think it's a 20th century novel. It's one of those books that gets into your sort of system, into your fibres, very few books do that. You know, you don't forget Ridley Walker ever. I mean, you can give that yeah. to sort of teenagers, and it blow
your mind as a teenager.
How he does a really brave, several brave things within the novel. Well, the thing that I loved was there are bits that are easy to understand. There are bits that you have to stop and try and work out. Mm. And there are parts that you're clearly not meant to understand.
Yeah.
That meaning has passed beyond the 20th century or 21st century's person's ability to decode it. That it's gone. It's too far gone.
Yeah.
Did you know, it's one of your favourite books as well?
It is, yeah. I think mostly for the kind of things that John was saying. Didn't he famously say he wasn't able to spell again after he'd written it? So that was it, he'd broken it. As I say, I've sort of read chunks of this out loud, and the patterns of it, because it's purporting to be an oral history as well, so you've got to be able to, we've got the text, but of course it is just spoken. Really, really visual, the kind of moments of the kind of set pieces and the payoffs. Extraordinary book.
I mean,
and a sense of, it's mythic, but a sense of hit the wheel of history turning and starting again.
The Wake by Paul Kingsnorth, I mean, you know, I know when we, picking up The Wake, I felt for the first time, here's a novel that's actually taken on Ridley Walker and it's a very different book. It's sort of set in the past, but what Paul Kingsnorth does in that book, you can feel, you know, he's been infected by this Ridley Walker virus. It's like that. It is properly viral. Once it gets into your bloodstream, you read differently afterwards. I think it's just.
There's another book that I read, which we'll come on to later in this podcast, which reminded me of James Joyce in a bad way. but this reminded me of Joyce in some ways.
Yeah, yeah.
It really reminds me of Under the Volcano.
Yeah, you know,
it cannot be understood at first reading. First reading is your prep for second reading.
Yep.
But while you go along, you get all this incredible stuff from it. So before I ask, just to say, listeners who complain that we don't give you enough notice before when we announce a book, I'm pretty sure we will do an episode on Ridley Walker by Russell Hoban. You might want to get in early.
There are other reasons
for reading books other than backlisted for enjoyment or pleasure.
As
I've discovered, just for 1 month. John, what have you been reading in this month?
Well, I've been reading something that is not remotely like Ridley Walker, but it is massively ambitious and something I would hugely press upon people. Crudo by Olivia Lang. Olivia Lang, known as a thoughtful, elusive, complex, brilliant writer of nonfiction. Her first book, which was To the River, which was kind of very English and deep and kind of Sebaldian. And then she wrote a very different book, which is about six alcoholic American alcoholic writers. And then she wrote The Lonely City, which was about alienation and loneliness and being in a city and painting. They're all beautiful, beautifully written books. But this is her first novel, and it's called Crudo, which is Italian for raw. And what she's done is in a very similar way, but in a very different way to Ali Smith. It was written very quickly, 7 weeks, in the summer of 2017. She's tried to capture what's happening in the, it's kind of like the book is a tumult of images, of Twitter feeds, of things happening, news stories.
Yeah.
It's hot. The planet's under threat. It's brilliant, sort of almost sort of masterclass in how to sort of go from the absurd to the serious and back again. I absolutely loved it. It's the premise of the book. This is what makes it is that the I in the book, the narrator of the book, is Kathy Acker, the punk controversialist mm-hmm. who died in 1997 of cancer. This is as though Kathy Acker is 40 and has decided to get married, and it's the preparation, the run-up to the marriage. The fact that you know that Olivia Lang recently, or despite writing brilliantly about the joys of living on your own and married Ian Paterson, the poet, who was previously, who was the widower of Jenny Diskey, wonderful writer. So it's kind of Olivia Lang, but it's also Kathy Acker. It's about identity. It's about language. It's about news. As far as plot goes, she does get married. The husband, Kathy's husband in the book, wins a poetry prize, which is exactly what happened to Ian Paterson. And then Kathy takes a flight back to America. What she's doing is like if you can imagine Virginia Woolf, but on kind of amphetamines. You know, it's like it has that sort of... It is, you're inside this incredibly kind of... I'll read a tiny little bit, because you're inside a conscious... Studio visit accomplished, PG tips drunk, Kathy went back to King's Cross and met Jenny in the pub. They talked about marriage, how to do it so it didn't bury you beneath all its baggage. They thought they had a handle on it. They thought they could see a way to maintaining their dignity, independence, autonomy, style. But it was touch and go, and they both admitted. Place, cards, stag do's, the whole thing was fucking repulsive. Someone, somewhere, had told her that day about hearing women say they were voting for Trump because they didn't want to work. I mean, Kathy said, 3 beers in, we could just fucking abolish not even gender, but people. I think I'm done. Home again, she went on Instagram. Rich, naked and pallid in the ruined, falled-out shelters of Orford Nest. Somebody's courgettes arranged and lit like a Renaissance painting. Over the course of the morning, she'd become an expert on neo-Nazis. She knew about the Oath Keepers and the Three Percenters. She knew that cops were even crazier and more racist and evil than she thought, which, speaking as a cop watcher, Rodney King and Michael Stewart, through to Philando Castile and Eric Garner, was maximally racist and unjust. It was late. She was up in her study, listening to trains and a neighbour or burglar hauling sacks of compost in their garden. Red lights, white lights. How close to the state do you want to get? Do you care for the state? Does the state mean anything to you at all? Kathy was a libtard, a regular schmuck, but she was also a biker bitch, a libertarian, live and let die. She didn't give a fuck. People could rip each other's faces off if that's what they wanted. Only she really hated a racist cop with a gun. Strip them and drive them through the streets like wild pigs. Wouldn't that be the best thing to do? Outside, a man was shouting, "No power, no power," in a resigned voice. A new camaraderie, a green square like a meadow. We can all be friends in. Kathy was tipsy and punchy. Kathy's hope is the hardest thing to hide. And so it goes on. It's kind of, yeah, I think it's as original and as odd and as brilliant and as... It's somebody, I think one of the reviewers said, the Kathy Acker in the book is, I think... really quite nice, quite likeable. More likeable, maybe, than Olivia Lang in 10.
Yeah.
So,
it's out
Crudo by Olivia Lang, and it's out now.
Out
is
now.
It paper?
Out now from Picador.
Okay.
I've got a proof.
You've got a proof. Yeah.
It's a hardback.
It's a hardback at $12.99.
Okay.
We'll pick this up again after some marvellously witty and interesting adverts.
About J.R.R. Tolkien, The Lord of the Rings. But before we start on that, we just wanted to say, okay, so John mentioned it at the start. There are two things it strikes me about us doing The Lord of the Rings on backlist. The first is, this is the least backlisted book of all time, right? Dan, you would agree with that.
I feel like I've sullied your reputation somehow.
Okay, that's the first thing. No, we'll come on to that, right? So that's the first thing.
Somebody always has to say.
And the second thing is, when I let slip that we were going to be doing Tolkien on Backlisted, several of our listeners expressed scepticism, yes. Right? And Anna Twigg, who we love, hello, Anna, quote, said, life's too short to read Tolkien. Oh. Right? Now, I'm not saying if I agree or disagree with that, but what I will say is, why does it provoke such strong reactions and strong emotions from people?
I think it's because it's so ubiquitous. I mean, it's almost a cliche in when you describe his name and the title, people's heads take them to a place that isn't actually in the book. And that's just because it's been so successful. I mean, 150 million copies I read, this has sold. And of course, the films, I think the films, I mean, that's something we'll come onto, I'm sure, which were absolutely fantastic, but very, very different to the trilogy. So, yeah, I mean, I'll be honest, I sort of submitted it to you both when I'd had a few beers. I thought, there's just no way they're going to do this. But I do, I genuinely think it is appropriate for Backlisted because it's hiding in plain sight. People don't read it.
Well, you know what, Dan? When John said, well, I'll tell you the story now. When John said to me, Dan wants to do The Lord of the Rings on Backlisted, wants to return the king, I just went, no way we're going to do, no way we're doing that. You know, I don't care if he is one of the sugar daddies behind Backlisted. There's no way we are doing the Return of the King. So we made, listeners, we made Dan write. something we've never done before. We made Dan write a paragraph on why he thought it was a good idea, we should do it. And he wrote the most, Dan, you wrote the most brilliant three-page pitching document.
Right. I'd have given that a first.
I really did, I really. Well, I don't have a degree, so I'll take that.
Well, I sent it to you, Una, didn't I? I said, will you come in? And you totally convinced me, and I think we can convince everyone who's listening.
Well, I hope so.
There's so much to talk about. Mm. Why do you think people glom on to Tolkien? They normally find it when they might read The Hobbit when they're a child, but why do they glom on to it as teenagers and then?
Oh, wow, interesting question. Well, I suppose detractors would say because it's adolescent and juvenile, I suppose, but they are, of course, extremely wrong. Why as teenagers? Oh, gosh, well, it does have simple emotions in it. They are the simple emotions, joy, happiness, loss. It's incredibly intense. Cast your mind back to being 14. The world is ending every 10 minutes, isn't it? Or remaking itself afresh or something. And then there's all the, you feel like you're falling into a bigger world. You feel like you're learning something or exploring something. And underpinning it in all this is he was a scholar. He was an Oxford Don. You are opening up worlds. There are people who've gone off and, you know, got nice careers as Anglo-Saxon lecturers.
I suppose the thing about it is you either really go for it or you really don't. Well, we've got a clip here, a Vox Pops clip. This was recorded 50 years ago on the streets of Oxford. And these are some students who were asked what they thought about Lord of the Rings. I comped together a few of them to give you the full range of opinions. So even then, people were either very pro or very anti.
No, I don't at all like Tolkien or what he stands for. It seems to me that his work implies an escape from political and social reality. Now, it seems to me is reprehensible. It's an implication of triviality, it's an implication of regression, a refusal to face up to our political and social problems, our religious problems of today.
The trouble is, of course, they make it sound like an intellectualised Dr. Doolittle. And no doubt before very long we'll have Lord of the Rings on Ice with Millicent Martin and Margaret Rutherford. But it will become a cult, as it is a cult in America now.
It gives you a nice sort of in-feeling to meet another Tolkien enthusiast who will know when you make references to things in the story, as though you're referring to history.
As we do in Spec Fickle.
Oh, exactly. The obscurer the reference, the better you feel when somebody else gets it.
Well, I, of course, haven't actually read Tolkien, but I think it's marvellous.
I think perhaps when he started off writing Lord of the Rings, as he's a philologist and an academic, he was most interested in the language. But the world that he created to hold the language took him over.
She's right.
Yeah.
She is right.
So I think we've dealt with why we want to talk about Tolkien. Dan, when did you first read The Return of the King?
Well, I was quite old. So, I mean, like most people, I grew up and it was on the bookshelf higher than I could reach. And it was like this enormous collection, this trilogy of books, which I never believed I would ever read. And I read The Hobbit quite young. And then I tried to read The Fellowship of the Ring. And like many people, I imagine, I got stuck at the Songs of Tom Bombadil and put it down. And then it wasn't until I was 25.
Lightweight.
I have jokes with friends about the Songs of Tom Bombadil. But when I was 25, I was actually working at the Idler and the films were coming out. And I thought, if I don't read this, then like I want the first time I encounter Lord of the Rings, I want to be the director. I want to be the casting director. I want to be in charge of the special effects. I want to do that in my own imagination before somebody else does it for me. And they did it utterly brilliantly. And so I started reading it on a Sunday. And when it came to Monday morning, I literally couldn't stop reading it. So I bunked off work, The Idler, which they approved of. And then I got to the Monday night and I literally couldn't leave the house. I just had to keep going. And I bunked off Tuesday as well. And I've never had a book do that. And it's like when you go running a lot, if you're lucky, you'll get the occasional runs where you get runner's bliss, where you feel like you're superhuman, you can go forever. This was like reader's bliss. It was like a way of accessing your mind or an escapism. And I love video games when I was a kid. And I see this as the original Zelda, the original massive...
Flow. It's about flow,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, okay, brilliant. Yeah, and it just... So, and I've read a lot about how there's a gap between what we know and what we can articulate in the way the mind works. So the part of your mind that makes decisions has no capacity for language. So you're always trying to bridge the gap between what you know and what you can articulate. And so I think because he was so talented with languages, I think he's doing that. He's playing in that part of your mind between those two worlds. And that he leaves enough for you to do and you can explore and range within it.
So one of the things you get with Tolkien that when people, the detractors, just to go back to, which is they say, you know, he's sort of cloth-eared, you know, he writes bad Victorian poetry. He was massively influenced, as a whole generation of readers, the Edwardian period, moving stuff. I mean, we'll probably talk again, but the best, I think the best book, and I know you agree, you know, on Tolkien that's been published in a long time is John Garth's Tolkien and the Great War. Mm-hmm. But the moving accounts of soldiers on the front with copies of William Morris's sort of Earthly Paradise and his quest poems, The Well at the World's End, that there was a vogue for that. But, and you know, people say, well, the language in Tolkien is self-consciously archaic. There's a brilliant thing here about that. It is, you know, the word fell. You can't help but notice the word fell all the time and the these and the thys and the hithers. But he, at the same time, you know, that the Wasteland was being written and that Virginia Woolf, he was doing something, he was moving in a different direction, but I think it was equally audacious. He says about Beowulf that the poet's style, when it was written in Anglo-Saxon, was already archaic. And he says this sort of thing, the building up of a poetic language out of words and forms archaic and dialectical or used in special senses, may be regretted or disliked. There is nonetheless a case for it. The development of a form of language familiar in meaning and yet freed from trivial associations and filled with the memory of good and evil is an achievement, and its possessors are richer than those who have no such tradition. And I have to say, if you want to explain why Tolkien is so massively popular, it is precisely because he doesn't try and write about the 1920s in a realistic or naturalistic way.
I think what's very interesting about the kind of archaic and the heroic language that's being used, so Paul Fussell is very good about this, how the sort of shift to things like glory and honour and triumph and helming and, you know, marching into battle, it's happening before World War One.
Yeah,
and Tolkien, who experiences the trenches, takes this language and with the language that he knows well, his knowledge of Beowulf, the heroic mode, and his actual experience of the worst, you know, war of the 20th century, he spins that in such a way that he's saying, here's the truth of what this is. I mean,
all
this
his friends, bar one, died.
Yeah. I would like to add to that. I was working for Waterstones in the late 90s when we did a big promotion on the books of the century, which was a big public vote, and perhaps inevitably the Lord of the Rings won that public vote. And although we got a bit of negative feedback about it, as you would expect, so I can remember
it being sneered at on Radio 4 the morning it was announced by Mark Lawson as being like a classic rucksack book or a school satchel book or whatever. I was very happy to go out and talk about it as a book of the century because it seems to me that it is a book about the 20th century, even if it wasn't intended as such, that it's a partly a book about what is one of the great themes of the 20th century. Well, unfortunately, it's about the industrialisation and mechanisation of mass slaughter, yeah. And that is the theme of the two world wars, and that's one of the themes of this book. And indeed, Dan, as you say, it's the theme of what happens at the end of the book,
yeah.
What happens to the Shire at the end of the book.
Yeah.
So we have a clip here from 1968 of Tolkien talking about what he felt The Lord of the Rings was about.
If you really come down to any large story that interests people, can hold them their attention for a considerable time or make the stories, practically always a human story, is practically always about one thing, aren't they? Death. The inevitability of death. I don't know whether you would agree with that, but anyway, that is what... there was a quotation from Simon Beauvoir that I read in the paper the other day, which seems to me put in a nutshell. I think I'll read it to him. There is no such thing as a natural death. Nothing that happens to man is ever natural. Since his presence calls the whole world into question. All men must die, but for every man his death is an accident, and even if he knows it and consents to it, an unjustifiable violation. Well, you may agree with words or not, but those are the key spring of the laws of the ring.
I was very, very drunk. that's wonderful, though, isn't it?
Absolutely brilliant.
Absolutely.
And it is a book about death.
It springs biographically. He's orphaned very young. His father dies when he's three, and he comes back from South Africa with his mother, who subsequently dies in her 30s when Tolkien is about, he must have been about 11. So he and his younger brother are orphaned. They're brought up, they're left in the care of a family priest because his mother has also converted to Catholicism and been sort of ostracised by her family. And I think what happens to people when they lose parents at that very kind of young age, there's a sense of perpetual exile that, you know, paradise has been lost in some way.
You know, funnily enough, one of the other books of the century that I remember talking about is... Pale Fire by Nabokov, which has exactly the same theme in the idea of being exiled from Zembla, from the impossibly perfect world of your childhood, which perhaps didn't even exist in the first place, that you can never get back there.
And the Shire comes from his memories of rural Warwickshire, this sort of blessed time he has with his mother, he's homeschooled.
The Edwardian, that pre-lapsarian feeling that you get. I recently did the Pursuit of Spring by Edward Thomas, where he rides a bicycle. And it's the same, that kind of sense of things being in balance.
Mm.
And then the war destroys that.
Exactly that.
And I know that one of the things, when it was published in the 50s, that there was a lot of attempts to try and to cast, you know, Hitler as Sauron and the Second World War. But one of the great things about the Garth book is that because he basically has done an amazing research job of Tolkien's war, and he was at the Somme and, you know, saw and experienced, you know, horrific war at its worst, that the First World War, in a way, is a more... I mean, Tolkien himself resisted all attempts to try and read contemporary resonance into his work.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
quite rightly, because...
He also said, didn't he hates allegory, and he said it's not an allegory for the Second World War, but he did concede that the First World War was formative on it, I think.
What he has to say about allegory, it's in the foreword, isn't it? Gets to one of the other themes of the book. He talks about allegory being rooted in the domination of the author. It's the author forcing a meaning on the reader, whereas myth or the kind of story is in the freedom of the reader. And the other major theme of Lord of the Rings is domination, power, the use and abuse of power as well. So allegory is tied directly to theme.
There's a brilliant interview with him on BBC website where they raise the idea that it's about a Christian allegory. And he says that he thinks it's more of an allegory of the human race says, I've been impressed we are surviving because of the indomitable courage of quite small people facing impossible odds. Mm-hmm. They struggle on, almost blindly in some way. Frodo had very little idea, really. By the time he came to the end of the quest, he was beginning to understand things very much more. The wisest bit in the book is when Elrond says, the wheels of the world are turned by small hands while the great are looking elsewhere, and they turn because they have to, because it's a daily job.
Yeah. Dan, you were saying in your already legendary pitching document, I seem to remember, you were saying about power, though, what Una was talking about. Right, so the Return of the King, you specifically chose the Return of the King rather than the Lord of the Rings. And we should say that, in a sense, we can see the Lord of the Rings as one novel. Sure. We could see it as three novels, The Fellowship of the Ring, The Two Towers and The Return of the King, which is how it was published. Or we can see it as Tolkien would have preferred it to have been published, which is six separate books, sure, plus the appendices, plus the Silmarillion in one go. What is it about the Return of the King that you...
Yeah, so, well, for me, I mean, I listen to the audiobook, which is interesting because he starts by saying that don't read anything into it, it's just a story. But I, you know, I take the role of a reader. I'm of the view that you co-author books you read because of your own situation. So when I read it, I just became fascinated by the different ways in which man's relationship with power is explored. And it is very male, obviously, very few female characters. Mm-hmm. But I think that, I find that extraordinary because when I look at the story and I see Frodo with the ring, I see that we all have that power. We all have the ability to become wild in terms of our aspirations for success, for power. And that's very much the male journey, right? That you will go and make your mark on the world. Steve Jobs, make a dent in the universe. Yeah, yeah. This is the sort of narrative that you're supposed to follow as a man. And yet he just gives us character after character that can't cope with it.
Yeah.
And they cannot deal with that responsibility when it comes.
Refuse that as a set of heroic values that say, well, actually,
yes, exactly,
the heroic values are a small strip of land which you garden to the best of your ability. Yeah. On the woman thing, there are indeed...
there were air quotes there.
The woman thing. There are more named horses than named women in Lord of the Rings, which is better than actually better than The Hobbits. However, I will say, and I've read a lot of the scholarship on this kind of thing... when he is actually pretty good on women, I think Eowyn's story about the railing she does against the sort of injustice of her. She's got this wonderful line of, "Oh yeah, you want me here to keep the house,
but if you
all die, you won't want the house then. So you know, I can just get burnt to death."
And she gets the best scene in the entire.
Oh yeah,
killing the Witch King Ragnar. Sorry, spoilers.
Yeah,
you know what?
Every time I read
that, if any one of you are listening to this, come at me with a spoiler complaint on the Lord of the Rings, then you are fools. Yeah, you are fools.
But that is like the most extraordinary scene. I mean, it's brilliant. Also. And
he was once asked which character he most associated himself with, and it was Faramir.
Absolutely.
Oh, no way. He's my favourite character.
Yeah, well, of course he's your favourite. Of course he's your favourite.
Because he turns it down.
And he gets the girl.
He gets the girl, and
he turns it down.
He very sweetly says that Faramir's like him, except that Faramir has courage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a lovely
look. I love, I've just got to do this little bit about Sam as well, who's my other, obviously, the amazing character. And I thought this is just after Frodo has been taken from Shelob's lair and Sam thinks he's dead and he's taken the ring.
Have we picked out the same?
Oh, is it really? maybe, I'm sure. I'd love it because it's, you know, it's the most perfect moment which everyone should learn from, in the book at least. And so he's about to go into Mordor on his own to try and find Frodo. And it says, his thought turned to the ring. There was no comfort there, only dread and danger. No sooner had he come in sight of Mount Doom, burning far away, than he was aware of a change in his burden. As it drew near the great furnaces where, in the deeps of time, it had been shaped and forged, the ring's power grew, and it became more fell, untamable save by some mighty will. As Sam stood there, even though the ring was not on him but hanging by its chain about his neck, he felt himself enlarged, as if he were robed in a huge distorted shadow of himself, a vast and ominous threat halted upon the walls of Mordor. He felt that he had from now on only two choices, to forbear the ring, though it would torment him, or to claim it and challenge the power that sat in its dark hold beyond the Valley of Shadows. Already the ring tempted him, gnawing at his will and reason. Wild fantasies arose in his mind, and he saw Samwise the Strong, hero of the age, striding with a flaming sword across the darkened land and armies flocking to his call as he marched the overthrow of Barad-dûr. And then all the clouds rolled away and the white sun shone, and at his command the Vale of Gorgoroth became a garden of flowers and trees and brought forth fruit. He had only to put on the ring and claim it for his own, and all this could be. In that hour of trial, it was the love of his master that helped most to hold him firm, but also deep down in him lived still unconquered his plain hobbit sense. He knew in the core of his heart that he was not large enough to bear such a burden, even if such visions were not a mere cheat to betray him. The one small garden of a free gardener was all his need and due, not a garden swollen to a realm, his own hands to use, not the hands of others to command.
Oh, I mean, really honestly, good. It's right? Just, wonderful. Come on, yeah. People.
That's great.
Do you want my Sam bit from that moment?
Yeah,
this
go
is,
on.
This is Sam debating. I think it's just from before then.
He's
sort of realised that Frodo is thinks he's dead, and he's trying to decide what to do and wonders whether there is nothing to be done. Sam looked on the bright point of the sword. He thought of the places behind where there was a black brink and an empty fall into nothingness. There was no escape that way. That was to do nothing, not even to grieve. That was not what he had set out to do. What am I to do then? He cried again, and now he seemed plainly to know the hard answer. See it through. Another lonely journey, and the worst. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah.
Not even to grieve.
Not even to grieve.
That even grieving is living.
I mean, that particular bit of the book, the crossing of Mordor and the...
No one does despair.
Eventual.
No one does despair.
I mean, it's 50 miles of... I mean, and the descriptions... I mean, there are a couple of descriptions which are have to be... I think he did say that there are a couple of the landscapes were influenced by the song.
Absolutely.
But also the sense
bodies in the marshes.
We were saying, like, the way one of the things that I really sticks in my memory from the first time I read the Lord of the Rings, which I think I was 12, is those scenes and the physical suffering of Frodo and Sam go on much, much longer than any normal novelist would do. They keep going. In fact, they take up effectively 2/3 of the whole of The Lord of the Rings. And I wondered whether that sense in the trenches of you would live through hell.
Yeah.
And it would only be one day, and then the next day you'd do it again.
Yeah.
Is one of the things that's feeding into that, right?
Yeah.
There's a lovely thing that C.S. Lewis reviewed it in 1955, and he says, this war, he talked about it, it's surprising realism. This war has the very quality of the war my generation knew. It is all here, the endless, unintelligible movement, the sinister quiet of the front when everything is now ready, the flying civilians, the lively, vivid friendships, and the background of something like despair, and the merry foreground, and such heaven-sent windfalls as a cache of tobacco salvaged from a ruin. The author has told us elsewhere that his taste for fairy tale was wakened into maturity by active service. That, no doubt, is why we can say of his war scenes, quoting Gimli the Dwarf, there is good rock here. This country has tough bones. And I think that's true. I think he writes about battle a lot, Tolkien.
We were talking... I'd like to go back to this idea that the book could have been published in a number of different ways.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think is fascinating about the phenomenon of Lord of the Rings is the constant tension from its very first publication through to the present day of, on the one hand, the aims of the author or authors, if we bring Christopher Tolkien, his son, into the picture, and the response from the publishing world and the public. That tension was there from the beginning. It's ongoing, seems to be ongoing now. And one of the things that happens to The Lord of the Rings is its first paperback edition is published in the mid-1960s in America. The perfect moment for it to be discovered by the counterculture. Yeah. And it becomes the counterculture Bible. That's why you hear Led Zeppelin. Sounds funny to us now, listening to hear Led Zeppelin.
So glad you played
but
that.
In the context of the counterculture, it's the core, one of the core counterculture texts. And there was a constant, and there has ever ever since been a tension between how do I, the author, process these people not understanding my book? And this goes back to what I was talking about the tension between what the Tolkiens wanted these books to be and how they have been received by millions of people. Yeah. Christopher Tolkien said, well, the films are terrible because they've been made mechanically for an audience of 14-year-olds, and they've only taken the things in the books that 14-year-olds would like. Yeah. And actually, going back to it, I have some sympathy with that.
I certainly have sympathy with that over the Hobbit movies, don't even go there. I think that the films are intermittently successful. I think Fellowship is probably the best adaptation.
You expect that because Fellowship is the book that is most narrative-led, right?
Yeah.
I thought Two Towers was... I mean, I think the battle scenes is pretty spectacular in Two Towers. But, they have to have silly
bits. Tell us what they leave out of the film of Return of the King.
I was just going to defend the films just a little bit first, just because when you watch all the extended editions, as I have, the amount of work and the amount of love in that film is enormous. And
yeah, I agree.
And I would hate the thought
Rereading Return of the King as I was this week and seeing how beautifully they adapt.
Yeah, and they've taken lines. I mean...
It's made with great love.
It's made with great love, but... So that's the I do think they're wonderful, but so what actually happens in Return of the King is that Saruman and Wormtongue are not killed. He doesn't fall off the Tower of Orthanc and is not impaled on a spike. He is a let go, and he wanders the wilderness. And what happens when the hobbits return in their finery and having literally saved the world? They get back to discover that Saruman and Wormtongue have scoured the Shire. They have destroyed it, they have felled trees, they have burnt things, they have enslaved the hobbits. And it's purely out of spite, because he felt they were up themselves and needed to be taken down a peg or two. So they get home without all their fame and without their incredible friends, and they have to fight all over again. And it's the reason it's my favourite bit of the book is, and I see it as a meditation on success, because anybody who's had any kind of success will tell you it feels amazing, and then you go home and you have the same arguments and the same mundanity. And I just love the fact that he doesn't let them off that hook.
Yeah.
He makes them go back and rebuild and fight again.
There's the beautiful thing also, I think, is Frodo coming back.
Yeah, he's so changed.
And there's that lovely thing where Frodo, again, spoiler alert, at the Greyhavens. So... Sam says, you know, I thought you were going to enjoy the Shire too for years and years after all you've done. So I thought too once, but I've been too deeply hurt, Sam. I tried to save the Shire, and it has been saved, but not for me. It must often be so, Sam, when things are in danger. Someone has to give them up, lose them, so that others may keep them. But you are my heir. All that I had and might have had, I leave to you. And also you have Rose and Eleanor, and Frodo lad will come, and Rosie lass, and Merry and Goldilocks and Pippin, and perhaps more that I cannot see. Your hands and your wits will be needed everywhere. You will be the mayor, of course, as long as you want to be, and the most famous gardener in history. And you will read things out of the Red Book and keep alive the memory of the age that is gone, so that people will remember the great danger, and so love their beloved land all the more. And that will keep you as busy and as happy as anyone can be, as long as your part of the story goes on.
I think the last 3-4 chapters of The Return of the King are as good an ending of a novel as anything in 20th century literature. And I think particularly actually The Scouring of the Shire and The Grey Havens. That last 2 pages in particular, again, and spoilers, I don't want to read it out because you've either read it and you'll have it in your own head, but it seems to me so well-judged, perfect, sad, the idea that you are passing from something. And then you have that amazing final line
gathered onto the hearth and the child passed.
Wonderful, It
seems like an odd thing to talk about, but John and I run a VC-backed technology business. So we spend a lot of time with incredibly rich and successful people. And I have met billionaires that are like Frodo at the Grey Havens. They have achieved huge success, and they have got to a point where it wasn't what they thought they were going to get isn't there. And I think this ties into the whole problem with men and power is that they get power and it isn't what they thought it would be and they can't cope with that. And then the rest of us pay various prices as a result.
Just to pull back to one of the other books we were talking about earlier, Ridley Walker, he dispatches with this in the first paragraph. Ridley goes on a boar hunt and hunts a boar and kills his boar and proves he's a man. And it's all in the first paragraph. He goes, it all felt a bit stupid.
But that is a very particular type of despair, which not many people will feel sympathy for, but it's a powerful thing to experience.
But you know what? I think there's an... I hear what you're saying, Dan. I think there's a thing... One of the things I think resonates with people when they read The Lord of the Rings, that the process you've referred to might equally apply to a period of illness or a period of fighting. You know, I love... There's a brilliant quote about writing a book. Reading this book reminded me of writing a book in as much as... It is naive to think that the writing of the book will not affect you and that you will be the same person at the end of writing the book that you were at the beginning. That you are changed by something that becomes like the cast left by the worm, effectively, that you're somewhere else. Yeah. You've crawled through the book. The book is the evidence of you passing through it, but you're not the same anymore.
On Scouring of the Shire, I completely agree that it's like the book in microcosm. You've got sort of, it's about tyranny.
Yeah, and like without resistance. It's totally out of balance.
Yeah, yeah, it's bringing it all home. It shows you that everything that was happening that was heroic and grand in all these big places matters down on the smallest places as well. And it also has one of my favourite lines of the book, which is Sam's dad skewering him.
Yeah.
What's become of your Westcott son? Oh, you're at home with ironmongery. We're as well known. It's just like, I've just saved the world. And you're humiliating me in front of my girlfriend.
I love that. There's a brilliant thing that just that Ronald Hutton, the historian, said, which about the kind of the world, which I loved. You going back to your PowerPoint, he says that it's basically the physical, the Middle Earth is like the geography reflects that of the post-Roman Europe. Most of its western sector is a land of ruins, half-remembered great rulers, economic contraction and small successor states. Its northeastern population populated by different warlike peoples in a state of constant flux with vast forests, subsistence agriculture and wooden trading posts. Its southeastern quarter containing Gondor, a centrally governed, urbanised and literate remnant of the former imperial state. In true post-Roman manner, the northern frontier of the latter is guarded by a settled group of barbarian federates, the people of Rohan, who formed a province as a separate kingdom while bound by treaty to aid the remainder of the empire when required. So Gondor is a Byzantium and Rohan is the Viking world. Yeah. And, of course, medieval England is the Shire. Yeah.
I remember somebody saying to me once that this is a sort of fantasy in a way of Tolkien is sort of human, unifying Roman and Anglo-Saxon culture in this book. It's sort of like,
but he was setting out to write a mythology.
Yeah, that's a mythology for
England. I'm gonna have to reminisce now because we're coming on to something that I really want to talk about. In 1980, I won the only prize that I've ever won for anything, right? Which was I read the scene in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy where the bowl of petunias gets turned into a sperm whale and a bowl of petunias. I've read that out loud. I won the spoken English prize at my school. And with the book token, I got the hardback of The Fellowship of the Ring. Right. And that was the first. I was 12. I read The Fellowship of the Ring. Then I went out and with the book tokens for my birthday or Christmas, I got the hardbacks of The Two Towers and The Return of the King. I read those. I read them 3 or 4 times. And then I went out and I thought, wow, what am I going to read next? I know. They'll get the follow-up, The Silmarillion. So 1981, I begin to read The Silmarillion. And in 2018, I finished it. Right. I read Silmarillion last week. And I did it. I got the audiobook and the copy of the book that I bought in 1981. The audiobook is done by Martin Shaw of The Professionals. Ooh. And listen, he deserves a knighthood for reading out the names apart from anything else. So what I did was I read along with Martin Shaw, and sometimes I put Martin Shaw on triple speed just to crack on through it. But before I tell you what I thought about The Silmarillion, a couple of months ago on The Archers, Linda Snell read Rob's favourite book, The Silmarillion,
And this is her. This is what she says about the Silmarillion.
You've got to read it.
This is what she said. Here we go.
I have never been so bored in my entire life. There is no way this could be described as literary fiction. It is a collection of random notes cobbled together after Tolkien's death, which, in my opinion, puts a rather large dent in his reputation.
But he creates an entire world.
He creates, at infinitely tedious length, a personal fairyland, peopled by this vast array of interchangeable characters, all with silly names. The whole thing is turgid, bloated, sententious.
Oh, I'm sorry you didn't
like it. In my personal catalogue of unreadable books, it definitely earns the number one spot.
There's plenty of people like me who believe it's a masterpiece.
I know. I know. I can't begin to explain that, but I deeply regret the 10 days of my life that I have devoted to the wretched thing.
Feel better now?
That's
unbelievable.
She read it in 10 days.
When amazing. I said that I was reading this on Twitter, the reaction that I got to that I was just from reading a book was incredibly strong from people coming back, the minority of whom said, it's great, the vast majority of whom said, why are you putting yourself through this? And Chris McCrudden, who's a listener who we love, Chris, the industry expert, said that is a terrible, terrible book. I actually ended up thinking that it's not a terrible book. It is, and in fact, in artistic terms, it's very true to the goal that first J.R.R. Tolkien and Christopher Tolkien set themselves. So what it is it's not an easy book to read. And it's a very poor follow-up, if you think of it as such, to Lord of the Rings. And this goes back to that tension I'm talking about, the tension between what the Tolkiens were trying to create and then being totally banjaxed by the massive cultural and commercial impact it has. And if you go back to the Silmarillion, which we all remember from our childhoods, I think, I mean, it's one of the biggest publishing events of the 70s. If you go back and read...
I got it when it came out.
You go back and read the jacket blurb, what's fascinating is I'd always thought the publisher had misrepresented it, right? You go back to the jacket blurb, it basically says on the jacket blurb, don't expect
Lord of the Rings, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They didn't misrepresent it. In fact, it's the it's the public. The public are cross that they don't get another Lord of the Rings, right? And actually, I really respect Christopher Tolkien and HarperCollins, as it became, for staying relatively true to the goals of the project, which was produce one difficult-to-read volume after another, which nevertheless, at this point quite serious, nevertheless accurately represent J.R.R. Tolkien's life's work. Yeah. That's what he wanted to do, and we could pass judgment on that. Yeah. But
and whether or not you think that's more valuable than, you know, the collected works of T.S. Eliot or... You know, I do think he's. I think he is a great artist. I think he's doing something. It's so remarkable when you the scale of it, the energy. I mean, it's like you, Andy. I don't think the Silmarillion is a bad book. I think it's quite hard work.
But I wouldn't want to read really challenging books all the time. I try and read a mixture of things, but in the case of the Silmarillion, I sort of thought, do you know what? I'm really pleased I read it because, guess what, I understand it much better for having read it. I didn't enjoy it a great deal. I found it hard work, but it gave me an insight into the Lord of the Rings and the insight into the Tolkiens and an insight into
his project,
world building.
Yeah.
Mythopoeia, I believe he calls it, doesn't he?
Legendarium.
But surely that has to be why it resonates. I mean, when I found out that he was... upset that we lost our mythology in England because effectively we inherited all these French stories of King Arthur and we had lost our mythology and he wanted
the
to
matter
create
of Britain.
One for this land. Yeah. There's a great quote where he says, it is in this world, it's just another stage of its imagination. So he was trying to lay that down. So for me, it's the kind of building blocks that you don't see that give you Lord of the Rings. And that is such an audacious thing to...
It's texture, it's the stuff that you have imagined.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that you know intimately. And this is true for building a character in a realist novel. The stuff that you know about the way they move, the way they speak, the way they comport themselves in a room. And for Tolkien, it's just from the ground up. It's, you know, down to the names of the flowers. It's down to the... you know, the way the river tinkles.
It's such a celebration of language.
What I loved in the book, which you don't get in the films, is, you know, that you realise that the whole... It's not just Gondor, all the regions of Gondor and the sense of the cultures. And I love I thought that was also a travesty in the film, that the Woses, the wild men, yeah. Ganbury Gunn, who is a kind of, you know, a sort of remnant, a kind of Neanderthal sort of...
Wild men.
There's just, like you say, the layering is so... And yes, sometimes the lists of names of mountains and things can get, you know, can weigh you down. But part of it is just, part of that is rendering something so completely in three-dimensional, as you say, in terms of texture. It seems odd to me that a book that's been so loved by so many people and I think has been massively influential. I mean,
well, because contemporary fantasy wouldn't exist as a genre without it. Or
that is true, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, my instinct is that that's true.
And even if it's just a case of, Moorcock or Mieville reacting against it, I think possibly we're a little bit past that now.
Yeah.
But all those sort of big blockbuster 70s and 80s
I must have read Lord of the Rings half a dozen times when I was a teenager.
Stephen Donaldson.
Right, I read Stephen Donaldson once.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not even... It's like a bad glass of...
Actually, you know what? Yeah. You know what I did for this, in addition to reading The Silmarillion? I listened to the music at the start of this episode is the theme music from the BBC Radio 4 adaptation of Lord of the Rings. Really, I went back and listened to that. Oh, my God, it's so brilliant. It's got Ian Holm in it. It's got Michael Horden as Gandalf. It's got Robert Stevens as the most unsavoury Aragorn.
I know,
all the time. It's got John LeMessurier in it. It's got Bill Nye.
It's incredible. If you've not, really outstanding. I think I heard that before I read Lord of the Rings. It's quite hard for me to sort of disentangle them in my mind, actually. No, it's absolutely superb. Really, amazing. Really good, yeah.
And nature too. I mean, got to just chip that in. Like the writing,
the
natural world is completely...
And I
grew up in Hampshire and the New Forest, and when I read it, it takes me home. And I think whenever someone reads it, if you have that tie to the natural world or you grew up in that environment, you're seeing your own the landscape of your childhood when you read it. And that's why, for me, it's such a comforting book.
Right. Well, it seems painful to leave the shores of Middle Earth, as always. But we shall do it.
Let's sail into the Grey Havens.
There's a pub called the Grey Havens.
Anyway, huge thanks to Dan and to Una and to our producer Nikki Birch and to Unbound and to our hip hugging sponsor Spoke. We just got time to slip in a quick Unbound project worth backing. Rather on message, I think it's Dice Men, Games Workshop, 1975-85 by Ian Livingstone and Steve Jackson.
We should do a backlisted on Warlock of Firetop Mountain.
I'll be back.
Well, look, it's Ian and Steve were the Games Geeks who founded Games Workshop in the flat in Shepherd's Bush in the 1970s. The journey of how Games Workshop grew into becoming the world's leading fantasy game specialist is exciting and unlikely as a game of Dungeons and Dragons. It's 88% funded. And there's still lots of fabulous rewards on offer, including lunch with the authors. It is pure geek gold. Remember, if you pledge for it or any of the other 312 Unbound projects currently live on the site, you'll get free postage on that pledge by entering the special code Tolkien as you check out.
You can download the podcast, plus follow up all the links, clips and suggestions for further reading on our website, backlisted.fm. And, of course, you can and will still contact us on Twitter, Facebook and Boundless. We hope you've enjoyed it as much as we all have. God, I was looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, me too.
Oh, God, I really, even as I slogged, as Martin Shaw pushed me unwillingly through the Silmarillion, I thought this is going to be brilliant. Dan, it has been brilliant. Thank you so much for choosing it. If you've enjoyed it, please consider leaving us a review with appropriate stars, if you feel so moved, on iTunes or whichever platform you get your podcasts.
Thank you, folks. We'll be back in a fortnight. Until then, fare forward, travellers. If you prefer to listen to Backlisted without adverts, you can sign up to our Patreon. It's www.patreon.com/backlisted. As well as getting the show early, you get a whole 2 extra episodes of what we call Locklisted, which is Andy, me and Nikki talking about the books, music and films we've enjoyed in the previous fortnight.